The world took off its battered war helmet a century ago and declared with a wounded wail that it was finished with war forever. But even that urgent impulse at the end of a horrendously savage and devastating war was grimly forfeited by humanity's relentless perversity for sinister error, gruesome folly, mass psychosis, and loathsome horror. And that's a quote from the famous Anon. A full century afterward, in the fluorescence of a new millennium, world leaders gathered in Paris to commemorate Armistice Day 100 last weekend, shadowed by their predecessors, who were pressured by the fervent mass of humanity to put an end to war. One of those predecessors loomed largest, the American President Woodrow Wilson, who had a plan for peace. Unfortunately, this new millennium's current American president might be the antithesis to Woodrow Wilson, whose dream of a League of Nations to prevent war is absolutely contrary to Donald Trump's virulent nationalism of America first. Trump went to Paris in a petulant smolder of anger and vengeful self-pity, which are bulwarks of his psycho-choleric narcissism. He had just experienced substantial electoral losses to his right-wing political party and was denied his cherished despotical desire for a massive military parade past the White House on Veterans Day. Perhaps his sour petulance was the reason Trump declined to pay respects to American dead of World War I, buried in a cemetery outside of Paris, though he claimed foul weather as his excuse. But back stateside, he also neglected to visit the military dead at Arlington on Veterans Day. And that same day, imprudently, commanded that overseas military votes were not to be counted in Florida's compelled electoral recount of too close to call votes, which Trump called a dishonest process, but most likely due to incompetence identical to the 2000 presidential morass. The Wilsonian subrogate at Armistice Day 100 was the French president who decried nationalism as a betrayal of patriotism. President Emmanuel Macron said, "Old demons are rising again and history is threatening to repeat its tragedies. Peace is the utmost priority," he said, "because we know what it cost." The perpetually aggrieved Trump instead put on his MAGA, Make America Great Again, war helmet, and returned stateside as though he were a homecoming veteran. Recently, in seeming disdain for world peace, Trump arbitrarily tore up a vital treaty that forestalled production and emplacement of nuclear arms. Sequential to the centennial memory of Armistice Day, a worldwide influenza epidemic precipitated by World War I killed 20 million persons in its diaspora, twice as many as died in the war. And now, something I wrote on the subject of Armistice Day 100, breaking the world's heart. Begin with a quote by Leon Trotsky. History had already poised its gigantic soldier's boot on the antheap. And from Winston Churchill, and a knell rang in the ears of the victors, even in the hour of their triumph. The war to end all wars ended on November 11, 1918. The following year, the continuance of war was assured. World War I lasted 1,563 days, killed 10 million soldiers, wounded 20 million more, and cost more than $300 billion. The war destroyed empires and dethroned dynasties. The Hohenzollern in Germany, Habsburg in Austria, Romanov in Russia. New regimes were started at the war's final hours in Vienna, Warsaw, Budapest, Prague, and Dublin. Revolutionaries roared through Berlin and St. Petersburg. The killing stopped an hour before noon on November 11, 1918, after four terrible years of unimaginable bloodshed that nearly destroyed European civilization. Much of Europe was in ruins, its economies devastated. Millions were dead and millions more were displaced, homeless, hungry, hopeless. Within a week of the armistice, the 28th president of the United States, Thomas Woodrow Wilson, boarded a ship named after the nation's first president to attend a peace conference at Versailles in France. meeting at Versailles at the beginning of 1919 were the leaders of the victorious Allies who had defeated the Central Powers. Wilson, who thought of himself and his place in history as a peacemaker, was determined to imprint the great new power of the USA upon the proceedings. After all, the United States had turned the balance of a stalemate. The opposing armies were exhausted and decimated after more than 3 years of savage fighting, and whichever side America chose to back with its fresh millions of soldiers would win. It had chosen the British-French alliance over the Germans and Austrians, ostensibly in retort to Germany's unrestricted submarine warfare that sank ships Americans were aboard. Wilson was determined to make his famous 14 points the basis of the peace treaty, in particular, the final point. He had announced his 14 points of peace on January 18, 1918. Most of them dealt with specific details of the war in progress, such as the evacuation of Germany, Austria from the nations they invaded in 1914, but also issues of general importance like freedom of the seas in peace and war, adjustment of colonial claims in the interests of subject peoples. European colonial empires had been at their all-time peak the year World War I started, and hundreds of thousands of colonial troops were forced to fight on both sides. And the reduction of all nations' armaments to the lowest point consistent to their domestic security. The first point was about treaties, open covenants openly arrived at, that Wilson hoped would also form the conduct of the Versailles Conference. The final point, number 14, was the most important to Wilson, and the major reason he was in Europe against the advice of his Democratic Party back home. The formation of a general association of nations with the mission of preserving world peace, with mutual guarantees of political independence and territorial integrity to great and small nations alike. At last, to banish war, a dream of millions for millennia. This was Wilson's great dream. He campaigned for a second term as president in 1916 on a slogan that he had kept America out of the European war that had begun 2 years before. But in 1917, he sent American armies into the slaughter. Historian Garrett Mattingly, writing of an earlier era, captured Wilson's dilemma. To embark on war was to launch oneself on an irresistible current sweeping into darkness. Now the darkness was past, and Wilson was determined that it never happen again. He was obsessed with his responsibility for having sent his countrymen to war, and felt a haunting covenant with the dead. If ye break faith with us who die, poet John McCrae wrote, we shall not sleep though the poppies grow in Flanders fields. Wilson would keep the faith. But humanity responds quicker to hatred and opportunity than for peace for its own sake. Civilizations have profited immensely from wars, and warfare has progressed civilizations' expanse and technologies, not only for purposes of making war. Yet war has also turned out the light of civilization. Humanity has been set back centuries by its penchant for war, long periods of decline and retrogression, generations devoid of opportunity or hope. Wilson's purpose was to end these interminable cycles of darkness. He took charge of the committee that hammered together the first part of the Versailles Treaty, his 14th point, the Covenant of the League of Nations. The League was to consist of the signatory nations and others admitted by a two-thirds vote. The members were to protect each other from aggression, to submit disputes to arbitration or inquiry, and to abstain from war for a period of 9 months while the League attempted to settle tensions. All treaties between members that were incompatible with League obligations were void. All subsequent treaties were to be registered with the League. The League was to devote itself to problems of international disarmament, labor legislation, and health problems. The Versailles Peace Conference formally opened in Paris on January 18, 1919, with 70 delegates representing 27 of the victorious powers. The Germans were excluded until the treaty was ready to submit to them. Unfortunately, the drafting of the peace treaty was marked by violent conflict between the victors, who treated the conference as a brawl over spoils and acted as if their main purpose was to punish Germany for starting and losing the war. Germany was forced to acknowledge sole responsibility for starting the war and had to swallow military occupation by the Allies. Harshest of all, Germany had to agree to pay for all civilian damage suffered by Allied peoples during the war. a $32 billion reparation bill was presented, but the later rise of German nationalism stopped payments. Germany also had to give France, Belgium, and Italy 25 million tons of coal annually, and Poland seized mines in Upper Silesia that yearly yielded 45 million tons of coal. Germany needed at least 100 million tons of coal each year to fuel its industry and got less than half that. It was not unlike olden times when the conqueror dragged the conquered at his chariot's wheel, Wilson's closest advisor, Colonel Edwin M. House, said. American General Tasker H. Bliss was more perceptive. "We are in for a high period followed by a low period," he said. "Then there will be the devil to pay all around the world." The problem that eclipsed all others at Versailles was to quickly restore the productivity of a war impoverished by 4 years of war. The war's aftershocks were felt all over Europe. Hunger, cold, short-lived communist uprisings in Bavaria and Hungary, pogroms against Jews in Russia, emergency food sent to the Balkans and the Middle East. The Paris peacemakers acted as if these problems were unrelated to them, as if they were saving civilization by redrawing maps instead. Germany, even prostrate, was still potentially the greatest producer of Europe, which denied its industry, and energy had little chance of swift recovery. Greedy for land and treasure, determined to exact revenge, the great powers never gave Germany the chance to undo the damage it had initiated in the only manner it really could. Although Wilson's first point had insisted on open covenants openly arrived at, the conference was crippled by secret treaties that poisoned the cooperation that might have prevented the greater butchery of World War II 20 years later. Hardly anyone had the sense to realize that the Versailles Treaty's punishment of Germany was so iniquitously cruel that it would ultimately precipitate the Nazi counter-revolution that caused the next war. The secret treaties between the other allies triumphed over Wilson's 14 principles because they were vehemently defended by their perpetrators. While Wilson took the high moral road toward world peace, the allies gorged on the decayed corpse of the Central Powers, breaking up the Austro-Hungarian Empire and grabbing Germany's overseas colonies. By impressing an onerous peace upon Germany, the peacemakers continued the war by political vengeance and ignored, in S.L.A. Marshall's words, history's moral that war is mere butchery unless it gives rise to a more stable peace. "How can I talk to Wilson?" remarked French Premier Georges Clemenceau, whose intransigent hatred of Germany was a major obstacle to a just peace and a major factor leading to World War II. "How can I talk to a fellow who thinks himself the first man in 2,000 years who has known anything about peace on earth? Wilson imagines he is the second Messiah." Clemenceau, the old tiger, challenged England's Prime Minister David Lloyd George to a duel during the conference, which an exasperated Wilson barely thwarted. Wilson's high moral tone was no more palatable to the primarily Republican Senate back home, particularly Henry Cabot Lodge, his arch political foe, than it was to Clemenceau and the feasting allies. Article 10 of the Covenant was especially vexing to the Senate, by which Wilson had pledged the U.S. to join its allies of the League of Nations to preserve against external aggression the territorial integrity and existing independence, and that's a quote, of any member. That struck to one of America's bedrock fears, becoming entangled in Europe's perpetual wars. Involvement in World War I was only tolerated by the possibility it would put an end once and for all to warfare. At least the public supplying the troops and money was led to believe that opportunity. Political and business leaders feared more the supremacy of Germany in Europe, even though few had much love for either Britain or France. But Wilson, perhaps because the final responsibility for dispatching the soldiers across the Atlantic Ocean was his, truly believed America's purpose should be a crusade for lasting world peace. Unhappy with the peace treaty that came out of Versailles, yet hopeful U.S. participation would moderate its harsh features, Wilson became its most ardent salesman, particularly for his beloved covenant for the League of Nations. Wilson returned home in July 1919, convinced the Senate, which under the Constitution decides upon treaties made by a president, would be forced to approve this one by the mere fact of its accomplishment and what he thought was the powerful influence of world opinion. He misjudged the temper of his political foes, who were already upset that he did not include any of them in the peace negotiations in Paris and that he had not informed Congress of its proceedings. The first anyone on this side of the Atlantic learned of the treaty was through a leak by the Germans, who had purloined an earlier rough draft copy. If Wilson had been more conciliatory and less arrogant about the treaty, he might have seen it pass through the Senate with very few reservations. Instead, he refused any amending of it, perhaps rightly claiming that Congress could not change what a union of nations had decided upon. He was wrong. The struggle over the treaty regressed into a partisan brawl between Wilson Democrats and Senate Republicans, led by Lodge and a handful of irreconcilables who opposed the treaty in any form. This Senate of 1919 retained bitter memories of Wilson's attempt to pack it with Democrats the previous election year. Yet he still might have got the treaty passed if he had made a few compromises early in the fight for ratification. Wilson attempted to appeal to America's not entirely justified sense of itself as a compassionate nation. He emphasized the duties of a strong nation, and in 1919, as it was later in 1945, the USA was the most powerful in the world. It must not act as a master, but as the servant to humanity, he said. He called the Treaty of Versailles a great peace, the crowning achievement of my life to sign. It was, he said, a people's treaty, the first of its kind, a Magna Carta for labor and for women and children. It was the great humane document of our time, he said. Above all, the treaty contained Wilson's cherished covenant for the League of Nations. The League did not guarantee there would not be any more wars, he said, but it made war violently improbable, quote unquote, by setting up elaborate arbitration and a cooling off period that was the equivalent of a normal pregnancy. Wilson insisted that America's historical isolation from world affairs was over. Technology and the process of history had made Earth a single whispering gallery. And that's a quote. The U.S. would not survive peacefully or prosperously in a violent, impoverished world. The nation was unable to, quote, disentangle itself from the rest of humanity. Wilson warned that without a League of Nations, the world would soon be engulfed in a war more horrible than the war just ended, and the United States would not only be sucked into the next war, but in all probability would bear the brunt of it. Wilson might have quoted Seneca. We are mad, not only individually, but nationally. We check manslaughter and isolated murders, but what of war and the much vaunted crime of slaughtering whole peoples? And that was Seneca. What Wilson did say was, we of all peoples in the world ought to be able to understand the questions of this treaty, for we are made up of all the peoples in the world. Dare we reject it and break the heart of the world? Wilson believed the U.S. had an inescapable moral obligation to bear its share of the responsibility for world peace, and he was certain that a great majority of Americans favored the League of Nations. To that end, balked by the Senate, which he spurned, he took the treaty to the people. In September 1919, he made a whistle-stop campaign across the continent to save the covenant. He covered 8,000 miles and made 36 prepared speeches and numerous impromptu talks from the back of his presidential train in less than a month. He aroused tremendous enthusiasm in the West on his whirlwind tour, a huge reception in Seattle, along with a review of the Pacific Fleet. In Portland, he spoke to thousands after an automobile trip along the Columbia River Gorge Highway, during which a news reporter was killed in a traffic accident. Cars were parked along the road, and he was cheered all along the route. The tragedy is that his exhausting appeal to the voters was a disaster. The people could not vote for the treaty. Only the Senate had the power to accept or reject it. Wilson should have stayed in Washington and worked it out with the senators. Instead, in Pueblo, Colorado, he suffered a minor seizure, and the rest of the trip was canceled. Back in Washington, a few days later, he collapsed from a stroke that incapacitated him and eventually resulted in his death 5 years later. On November 19, 1919, the treaty was rejected by the Senate. Another try the following March was also defeated. The League of Nations was officially born January 10, 1920, though the Assembly met for the first time in Geneva, Switzerland on November 15th, a year after the United States declined to become a member. The League foundered from the start and was never able to curb powerful aggressors or to protect its weaker members. It was never a well-balanced supranational league and proved unable to enforce its decisions or deal with the economic problems that led to worldwide depression in the 1930s. By the time World War II began in 1939, the League had lost all prestige and influence. The League of Nations was crippled from the start by the defection of the United States, which broke the coalition of Allied power that might have kept the peace. Instead, the other nations responded to parochial fears and avarice and hardened their revenge against Germany. France, in particular, was stunned by the U.S. rejection of the treaty. And having already been attacked twice by Germany in the previous half century, enacted extremely cruel measures against its ancient enemy, which included a disastrous invasion of the Ruhr in 1923. The impossible burden of reparations on Germany economically unsettled Europe for more than a decade and contributed to the Great Depression, and also helped prepare for the rise of Adolf Hitler, which curtailed the reparations. Lloyd George blamed the failure to keep the peace on the Allied powers, who did not fulfill the intentions of the Treaty of Versailles and probably never had any intention of doing so. The U.S. role in the League's failure should not be exaggerated, yet World War I had transferred the wealth of Europe to the USA, and its real power was just beginning. The international anarchy and repudiation of treaties, acts of aggression, and the rapid growth of fascism that led to World War II reinforced the need for an organization better adapted than the League of Nations, which failed disastrously to preserve world peace. The United Nations was born in the midst of World War II. Simultaneously, Hitler formed his new order that was forged by Nazi Germany, fascist Italy, and their satellites, ruled by Quisling-type puppets in conquered Europe, as an anti-democratic, anti-communist bloc, and Imperial Japan attempted to consolidate its expanding empire in the war's early years into co-prosperity sphere, in which it claimed Asia for Asians. The ultimate total victory of the Allied powers, a new Big Three, with Soviet Russia supplanting Nazi-occupied France, achieved in large measure through an effective war mobilization of the world's resources, left them in a position to write the new peace treaties. The preamble to the United Nations Charter, which was adopted in June 1945, a month after Nazi Germany surrendered, after 12 years of its thousand-year Reich. But while Japan was desperately fighting to avoid defeat, stressed the determination to, quote, save succeeding generations from the scourge of war, which twice in our lifetimes has brought untold sorrow upon mankind. In August 1945, two atomic bombs were dropped by U.S. bombers on two Japanese cities. One war was over, but almost immediately a quasi-war that would last half a century was beginning. The Cold War and its reckless nuclear arms race between the two main victors of World War II sorely tried the effectiveness of the United Nations, almost to the portal of this third millennium of the Common Era. And the same constricted prejudices that doomed American participation in the League of Nations a century ago, in particular chauvinistic nativist nationalism, threatened more than ever the country's commitment to the promise of the United Nations Charter to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war. And that was something I wrote, Breaking the World's Heart, and it's revised from the North Coast Times Eagle, November 1989 and October 2001. And to continue the subject, an article in the Washington Post by David Ignatius. What would the ghosts of 1918 tell us about the perilous world today? What would the ghosts of 1918, not just the soldiers who were slaughtered in the trenches of World War I, but the statesmen who failed to make a durable peace afterward, tell politicians a century later about the perilous world we inhabit today? Ruminations about past and present are inescapable. The United States has just finished a snarling, bitterly divisive election, and we're all puzzling over how to interpret the results. President Trump, meanwhile, went to Paris to commemorate the armistice of what historian Margaret Macmillan has called the war that ended peace. I asked some of my historian friends to reflect on the lessons of 1918 for our post-election America. They cited some common themes: the fragility of the world order then and now, the big, sometimes disastrous outcomes that can begin with small events at the margins, the moral hubris that dooms inflexible leaders to failure, and the humility that allows great leaders to see events through the eyes of adversaries and thereby avert disaster. Let's start with the issue of leadership. Trump, in his first 2 years, unfortunately, has played the role of divider in chief. He tends to see himself as the victim in every drama, which makes it almost impossible to empathize with critics. When he sees a scab healing over a racial or ethnic wound, he often rips it off. He has turned resentment into a potent national movement. Trump's uncompromising style, observes presidential historian Evan Thomas, is weirdly similar to that of Woodrow Wilson, an idealistic Democratic president. Wilson failed to achieve his life's dream of ratifying the League of Nations Treaty because he couldn't find common ground with his chief adversary, Republican Senator Henry Cabot Lodge. In a recent study of leadership titled History's People, Margaret Macmillan writes that great leaders managed to avoid the trap of thinking they were always right. She says of Wilson, when he was convinced, as he often was, of the rightness of his cause, he regarded those who disagreed with him as not just wrong, but wicked. Does that sound familiar? Evan Thomas notes that Trump isn't alone in regarding his political opponents as bad people. These days, he says, everyone feels morally superior to everyone else. Tolerance is traditionally a core American value, but there is an emerging bifurcated moral intolerance that treats people with different views as enemies, Thomas says. Against this backdrop, let's look at the midterm elections. The results are a mixed bag, to be sure, but my sense is that America took a collective step back from the brink Tuesday, November 6th. The election was largely about Trump's leadership and balloting for the House of Representatives. The broadest measure we have of what the country thinks tells us that the nation wants a change from Trump's style of governing. This election was a character test for America, notes Rick Atkinson, whose Liberation Trilogy pointed... Damn it. Got something stuck in my throat. This election was a character test for America, notes Rick Atkinson, whose Liberation Trilogy painted an unforgettable portrait of U.S. leadership in World War II in Europe. You find yourself hoping for a savior, someone who will arise and become a statesman, but that's a fool's errand. Politics is a collective act, just as war is a collective act. The only safeguard against catastrophic leadership is sound public judgment. History is a recurring lesson in unintended consequences, argues Kai Bird, a Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer who is now working on a book about President Jimmy Carter. Bird's fascination with history began with Barbara Tuchman's The Guns of August, an account of the path to catastrophe in 1914. It's a saga, explains Bird, of how generals, kings, and presidents stumbled into war, each side thinking it would be over in a few weeks. For Bird, there is an eerie sense that we're on a precipice, again, because of possible political misjudgments. As a historian, I feel things are happening now that may have unintended consequences, especially with a president who is such a lone actor, who may be about to create a constitutional crisis by firing Special Counsel Robert S. Mueller III without knowing where he is heading. Democracy, in theory, is a self-correcting system. If voters think the country is veering in the wrong direction, they can do something about it by electing new leaders and changing course. That seems to be happening. Even with Republican victories in some key Senate and gubernatorial races, the electorate's unhappiness with Trump seems clear, as it does consistently in opinion polls. Trump can pretend that he won the midterms and continue on a course that a majority of the country appears to reject. But that would be a march of folly. And that is by David Ignatius, whose last line is the title of another book by Barbara Tuchman. And what he wrote was, "What would the ghosts of 1918 tell us about the perilous world today?" And he wrote it for the Washington Post, in which he is a twice a week Foreign Affairs columnist.